1978 oral history project on endodontics, interview with Dr. Lewis Grossman, conducted by Jay Marlin.
I think what I'd like to do, at least initially, is to get an insight into your background, what got you into dentistry, what interested you in endodontics in particular. And you had, I know, a very interesting educational experience dental-wise. You went to, I believe it was Rostock for...
Well, I went there for graduate work.
Mm-hmm. Could you go into all of that a little bit?
Yeah.
In your own, at your own pace, in your own way?
Okay, we'll try. Now let me know when you're going, you want me to start. As perhaps so many others who were interested in medicine, I was interested in medicine, but felt that it would be a rather uphill climb for my parents, and so I thought of osteopathy, which was a current substitute for medicine, and somewhat popular. It certainly is much less popular today than it was then. Then, meaning approximately 1919. At any rate, looking around for some other profession, I investigated not only osteopathy but chiropractics and decided against both. And I had gone to a rather fine dentist, and I looked up to him and began to think of dentistry as a profession. I went out to the dental school, and I walked into the lobby of the school, and approaching me was a gentleman, probably in his 50s perhaps, with a Van Dyke beard, wearing a long white laboratory coat, and he made an impression on me, sort of a father figure. And I went to the dental school to get a catalog on that particular day. At any rate, that person later turned out to be no less than Dr. Herman Prinz, P-R-I-N-Z. He was born in Germany, came to this, and he was a pharmacist. He came to this country and studied dentistry and decided to remain in this country as a dentist. However, I don't think he practiced a day in his life because of his knowledge of pharmacology, materia medica. He was snapped up by one of the dental schools at a Midwestern university, and he taught materia medica and pharmacology there. In 1915, our school was built, and at that time was considered the finest in the world. And it was without question the finest in the world because a great deal of money had been left for it to be built. Not only that, but we were very fortunate in having a fine dean. He looked around the country and outside the country. And he brought Dr. Prinz from one of the Midwestern universities, Dr. Hopewell Smith from England. He was at that time considered the foremost histopathologist. Dr. Gildersleeve, who was not a DDS, but a PhD, and one of the finest microbiologists in the country, and so on. It may interest you to know that our part-time faculty often served without salary because it was considered an honor to be associated with the University of Pennsylvania. School of Dentistry. At any rate, I kind of cottoned on to this gentleman, Dr. Prinz. I must say, in all humility, that because I liked him, I studied a bit harder for him than for some of the other professors, and we got to know each other, and he took an interest in me. Another person who took an interest in me was Dr. J.L.T. Appleton, who succeeded Dr. Gildersleeve. As professor of microbiology, Dr. Gildersleeve having died of cancer. And during my second year, I asked Dr. Appleton a question, how does one sterilize a toothbrush? Well, he had no ready answer for me, and since I was taking a technique course in microbiology, I asked him if I could do some experiments to find out. He encouraged me, and this was the beginning of my relationship with bacteriology and with Dr. Appleton. I mentioned these two people because they had a great impact on my future in the profession. Dr. Prinz gave the first course in oral medicine in this country, which he called non-surgical diseases of the mouth. He encouraged me to go to Germany to take graduate work, and after 5 years of practice, I closed my office, paid the rent, went to Germany, and studied at the University of Rostock, only because Professor Moral was considered the authority in Germany at that time in that field. Dr. Prinz, I'm sure, had it in mind to encourage me to follow in his footsteps. On the other hand, Dr. Appleton interested me very much in microbiology, and so we started a series of experiments which spread over a two-year period. And in 1931, the Dental Cosmos published four papers in succession, February, March, April, and May. The results of our experiments on so-called ionization or electrosterilization, which was at that time a very popular method of treating infected root canals. I practiced, of course, when I was graduated in 1923, and it's interesting to recount that at that time, it's interesting to recount that at that time, in 1923, there were X-ray studios where dentists sent their patients at times to have X-rays made. Actually, I spent a year as an associate of another dentist who did have an X-ray machine. However, he was using not Novocaine, but was using cocaine for injection. So, of course, I weaned him from the use of cocaine and substituted Novocaine. He was using Somniform, which was a gas composed of three gases, actually. I don't recall them all. And I urged him, because I felt that Somniform was somewhat dangerous, to get a nitrous oxide machine, which he ultimately did. He extracted teeth that required root canal treatment. And of course, under the circumstances, I did all the root canal treatment in the office.
How did you get interested in?
I became interested in root canal treatment in this for this reason. We did not have a separate root canal or endodontic clinic, but we had one end of our operative department. Perhaps six chairs which were devoted to root canal treatment. And I heard the teacher one day when I was a student say, "Well, after 13 treatments, we have finally gotten negative cultures, and now you may fill the root canals." Well, 13 treatments seemed like an awful lot of treatment, a terrific waste of time, and I felt that endodontic treatment could be simplified. And this is how I got interested in endodontics. Also, I should say, Dr. Prinz taught the subject of root canal treatment. And being a follower, a disciple, so to speak, of Dr. Prinz, I naturally became interested in it rather than in some other phase of dentistry. I was associated with this dentist for 1 year and then opened an office in the center of town in 1924. And I saw patients from 9 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock in the evening, when I had patients, meaning that I did not hesitate to work in the evening because I had so few patients. And those who came at all came mostly in the evening. At any rate, I built up a practice, and I must confess that the first year I did not have an x-ray machine because I simply couldn't afford it. I bought my equipment on time, and the cost of a machine seemed just way out of line in view of the fact that in the medical arts building where I had my office, just two floors below, there was this x-ray studio, dental x-ray studio. Also, there was a Dr. Chandler, an oral surgeon, one floor below, who also took x-rays films for dentists. From that you can tell that x-rays or radiographs were not as much in use in those days as they are today.
Let me ask you a question. Did you ever come in contact with Dr. Edmund Kells?
Yes, sir. I heard Dr. C. Edmund Kells give a lecture before the Philadelphia County Dental Society in the Bellevue Stratford Hotel. I was very much impressed by him because I had known that he was the first one in this country to have taken a dental radiograph. I might mention, I can't, by the way, recall which year this was, but I could look it up easily. I might mention that in 1928, when I was taking graduate work, Dr. Prinz, before I left, had given me 5 letters of introduction to various prominent people. One of those was Professor Otto Valkhoff. We owe the introduction of camphorated monochlorophenol to him. I believe it was in 1895 or 96 that he first recommended the use of camphorated monoclophenol as an antiseptic in the root canal. Professor von Kolff was then retired, of course. He was living in Lichterfelde, L-I-C-H-T-E-R-F-E-L-D, a suburb of Berlin. And I wrote to him and got a letter saying, yes, I could come and visit him. And so I did, and we had a beer together in his home, and he told me that how he lay on the ground for 20 minutes, not seconds, 20 minutes, 2 weeks after Rankine announced his discovery, and took an X-ray plate of his own mouth. This was not a periapical film. This was a glass plate before there was such a thing as a film. A sensitized glass plate which he wrapped in rubber dam. He then placed this plate in his mouth and closed his mouth. His teeth did not come together because of the size of the plate. And so the first dental radiograph was a bite-wing film. Yes, as we know it today. He then went upstairs and took down two tubes, one of which was the tube. It was a gas tube, naturally. At least I think it was, which he had used for taking the first radiograph. I also saw some others in the field of periodontics, like Hans Sachs and Professor Mamluk, etc., because Dr. Prinz also taught periodontics. And I was interested in periodontics as well, and also for a period of about 1928 to 1940. I treated some few periodontic patients referred by other dentists until finally quit, devoting my entire time to endodontics, but not before about 1945. I was in general practice with emphasis on periodontics and endodontics. But about 1945, I still had a few friends for whom I did general dentistry. A high school friend who, unfortunately, whom I lost just about 2 years ago, who helped to build up my initial practice. He was a lawyer. Our next door neighbor for a number of years, who was a physician, and we exchanged services, so to speak, and a half dozen others, but finally gave them up, of course. In any event, I must mention, amongst others, the close relationship I had with Dr. Edgar Coolidge. I was very fond of him, as I'm sure everyone who knew him was fond of him. He was a gentleman in the real sense of the word. He was, as well, a scholar. He also taught both root canal treatment and periodontics, and wrote a book on both subjects, just as Dr. Prinz did. He practiced both specialties when they were really not considered specialties.
Where was he located?
He was located in Chicago. And he did a great deal to advance the specialty of endodontics. I knew Rudolf Krumfeld, who was a very fine pathologist. I knew, personally knew, Gottlieb. Gottlieb received the Miller Prize, the W.D. Miller Prize, I forget the exact year, but somewhere in the 1920s or 1930s, for his experimental work on dogs in the field of endodontic treatment. I knew Professor Gottlieb through Dr. Prinz. He came during the sesquicentennial, which was held in Philadelphia, and the American Dental Association met in Philadelphia at that time. Professor Prinz introduced me to Professor Gottlieb, and to this day I recall that his address was number 9 Türkenstrasse in Vienna. I knew and corresponded with Gottlieb. I also corresponded around that time with Professor Oscar Mueller in Switzerland. He was a great advocate of pulp mummification, and I was interested in pulp mummification, and tried pulp mummification in some cases and abandoned it.
For what reason at that time?
I abandoned it because of reactions.
Could you go into that a little bit further?
Yes. There was a period in my own practice when I felt that pulp mummification was worth a trial. Namely, in such cases of molars which were difficult because of curved roots or dilacerated roots or some other reason, I felt that it was worth a trial. The result was that, and by the way, I should mention that when I was a student, the proper method for devitalizing a pulp, of extirpating a pulp, was arsenic trioxide. And so I used arsenic trioxide and devitalized the pulp and then used the Giese paste, also a Swiss product, which consisted of essentially zinc oxide, glycerin, and paraformaldehyde. Not greatly different from N2. Now, it was very simple to remove the coronal portion of the pulp after devitalization and then apply this paste, cement base, and an amalgam filling. But unfortunately, patients develop pain at times, and that is periodontal ligament pain, and at other times on checkup, areas of rarefaction developed. Now, I don't want to imply that this was the usual thing, but nevertheless, there were a sufficient number of cases which made me abandon the method.
About what time period was this?
I would say in the 30s. Bear in mind, too, that others were using this method around that period of time.
What was, what were more or less the common accepted types of endodontic treatment at that time? Obviously, this was one.
Well, let me tell you that when I was graduated from the dental school in 1923, the first meeting I went to was a debate between two physicians and two dentists. The title of the debate was, "Is the pulpless tooth a menace to health?" And one physician took the affirmative, the other the negative. One dentist took the affirmative and the other the negative. And as you would expect, I believe probably that those who believed in the focal infection theory went away convinced that it was a menace to health, and those who didn't went away absolutely convinced that it was not. The environment was such that relatively few dentists did root canal treatment. In the 30s, a large number of dental schools did not teach endodontic treatment, or else taught endodontic treatment only of anterior teeth or of single-rooted premolar teeth. It was not until the 40s that the tide began to turn, that we began to do more and more endodontic treatment, because the medical profession by that time was convinced that the great claims that had been made for the focal infection theory were without foundation.
Let me digress a little bit.
Yes.
Could you give me a more of an insight into Drs. Coolidge and Dr. Gottlieb, what effect they had on, say, the development of endodontics, and what effect they had on you personally?
Well, Professor Gottlieb had perhaps more of an effect on his disciples, namely Kronfeld, Orban, and Stein. These were his disciples who came to this country, Orban and Kronfeld. Kronfeld had written a very fine book. Orban, of course, later wrote his book. And they had an influence on endodontic treatment. Kronfeld more so than Orban. Orban was more interested in periodontics than he was in endodontics, although he was also interested in endodontics. As you can see from this, these two subjects were closely intertwined in the teaching of dentistry. Gottlieb had this influence, namely that of experimental procedures to determine or evaluate methods of treatment. Stein had perhaps only local influence. He too wrote a good many papers, but he digressed somewhat from endodontics and went into the field of, curiously enough, crown and bridge. I would say he was, in his day, one of the finest rehabilitation people. Going back to Coolidge was a scholarly, dignified person, a person you just kind of liked from the very first minute you met him. And he, in turn, turned out students, I'm sure, who went into the field of endodontics. Now, who they are, I'm sure someone from the Chicago area can tell you much better than I.
I believe that Coolidge used a sort of a split cone technique primarily.
Yes. It was called a sectional cone technique, in which he would cut segments of gutta percha cones roughly 4 or 5 millimeters at most in length, and dip each one in oil of eucalyptus to soften it slightly. And by means of certain pluggers, he would, after placing the first segment and condensing it, he would take a radiograph to see whether it was up there far enough. And if it weren't, he would condense it apically still more. Then he would mount, by means of heating the plugger, he would mount the next section of gutta percha, dip it in eucalyptus, and press it against the first and the third against the second, etc. That was his method. I've seen some very fine root canals filled by this method, and I've seen some poor ones where there were spaces between sections, just because the person didn't know just how to handle the gutta percha by this method.
And I imagine in those days the gutta percha was far different than what we have.
The gutta percha cone came to a point. They were bought in the following types. 2X fine, X fine, fine, medium, coarse, extra coarse. And they were all rolled by hand, of course. As a matter of fact,